to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys?
Well, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you guys a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We'll have S. Craig Zahler talking about some of his favorite graphic novels, and an essay from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin on Sally Menke, the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. We'll also have the great Matt Labash, who will weigh in on Marvel vs. Marty. Get to that in a sec. And Rebeller's own Dave Spielman will be lighting fires on the reg. We are paying good people good money for the content you are enjoying right now and elsewhere, and we hope you'll sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $1.99 a month or $20.19 for the whole year. And now, on to the show. First up is Controversies and Nontroversies. Is it time to break up Disney? Between the entertainment behemoth's stranglehold on theatrical distribution, where it has taken nearly 45 cents of every box office dollar so far this year at the domestic box office, and its new streaming service, which could well be a Netflix killer, Disney is getting too big to let anyone else succeed, kind of. There are all sorts of sub-controversies at work here. Matt Zoller's sites had a great in-depth piece of reporting on Disney locking up 21st Century Fox's film library, and Martin Scorsese is kind of been part of a long, ongoing lament about the dominance of Marvel on the cinematic universe landscape. But the biggest question is simple and kind of confounding at the same time. So I want to ask the resident libertarian, Peter, doesn't the dominance of Disney represent a marketplace failure?
No, not at all.
The market can't fail. It can only be failed, right?
Look, Disney has... The reason that Disney has the marketplace dominance that it has is that they have become extraordinarily good at creating products that people want to pay for. And so if you think about we are somewhat lucky in that when we go to the movies, for the most part, it is free. It's part of our jobs. This is something that we get to do that we are really quite privileged to be able to do on a regular basis. And if you've done it for a decade or plus, like many of us have, you sort of forget this. Movies are expensive. And they're not just expensive in money. They're expensive in time. And so trying to take you, yourself, your whole family to a movie, if you want to do that and you're paying for extra tickets or you're paying for a babysitter for a whole family, an evening at the movie easily runs $75 or $100. Mm. And so what people want in many cases for movies is a sure thing. And what Disney provides with Marvel, with Pixar, with even to some extent with the Star Wars movies, I think they're struggling there a little bit, but what they provide is a sure thing. A movie that is going to work pretty well, that you're going to be pretty pleased to have spent $70 for your family to see, that is going to entertain you enough, that is going to make you feel pretty good, that is probably going to be extremely well crafted, that is going to be funny at times, that is going to be generally enjoyable and engaging, not dark and paranoiac, it's not going to spread messages that are divisive, that are the kinds of things that you don't want your family to see. Disney has gotten very good at making low-risk, pretty good movies. Now, there's something to be said for the idea that perhaps Hollywood studios that have hundreds of millions of dollars to spend should occasionally be making higher-risk films. This was a core point that Martin Scorsese made in his New York Times op-ed, is that what they've really done is eliminate risk from the movie product. At the same time, look at what Netflix is doing. They just spent nearly $200 million to make an incredibly high-risk, unsellable Martin Scorsese movie. And so there is still an opportunity for those movies to be made and for people to see them. In fact, there is arguably more opportunity for people to see things like that than ever before, thanks to services like Netflix and even maybe coming up, Disney Plus, because... remember when 20, 30 years ago when we were young people who were sort of we're that old. When we were young and we were seeking out movies that were difficult to find, like, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be years before you found a copy that you could take home and watch. If a movie wasn't playing in the theater, and small art films, if you didn't live in New York or L.A. or someplace like that, you couldn't see a lot of stuff, or you couldn't see it till it came out on video, and maybe not until months and months after that, and you had to special order something from a mail order catalog where everything took 8 weeks to be delivered, and the VHS copy costs $30. Everyone in the world, everyone in the United States, and many, many, many people around the world are going to have an opportunity to see Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, a completely unmarketable, huge budget movie starring three guys in their 70s, for $8 a month.
Yeah,
that's a good thing. We live in a good marketplace for movies, for filmmakers, and for moviegoers.
But that is not even close to how much Netflix costs anymore.
It's like
$16.
Isn't the low end? It's $12 a month.
So
it's less than the price of an evening ticket in New York or L.A.
Right. So that's the case for sameness and blandness at the multiplex, Alyssa. What do you think? Do you think that we, living in a world where you have a bunch of sure things and Marvel uses its massive marketplace near monopoly to demand from theaters that they get tons of screens for long periods of time, get a huger cut of the proceeds than anyone ever has before, and simultaneously lock up all of the things that they have acquired through their various tentacular reaches into the entertainment industry and put into their vault. Do you think that that's good for the state of film going and for film viewers?
So, as you said, there are a lot of parts of this story. And to start with just one of them, I think we can all agree that on one level, Martin Scorsese is right. That the superhero movies that have become the dominant form of entertainment do not represent and do not try to represent the whole of the human experience, right? So we have settled into...
There are several superpowers that have been left out, yes.
I mean, but there's also, like, sex, having kids, you know, huge parts of life that are just not represented or really discussed. So I think that is just... like, Martin Scorsese is right. You cannot actually argue that the dominant mode of cinema addresses or seeks to address the whole of the human experience.
It's not art. And this is what he is saying.
Whether it's art.
Cinema versus, like, kind of, you know, entertainment.
That's where this started, was his quote that it's not cinema.
Right.
Right. And you can quibble over the definition of cinema all you want, right? I mean, these are movies. They're projected in theaters. Whatever. But they do not tell the whole story of the human experience. They are not interested in doing that because you cannot market the whole of it, the human experience all around the world and make an enormous amount of money. You cannot argue over what the human experience is, whatever. I think that's not a great thing. From a sort of competitive power perspective, I don't even know that all of these brands being under the same roof is good for them, right? I mean, when you're talking about Disney, you know, Peter, you didn't name almost a single Disney movie, right? These are all acquisitions that Disney has made over time.
And this is a point that Matt Stoller makes in a very interesting piece in his newsletter stack or whatever those things are. The argument that Marvel is essentially in an imperial mode right now, that it is Disney is. Right.
It's like we've got them all confused.
And Marvel is the favored kingdom.
Yes.
Right. But so... You know, you have this company that has enormous market power that homogenizes a lot of its offerings in a lot of ways. I mean, Marvel has sort of insulated itself against a certain amount of criticism by hiring a young, diverse, interesting group of directors who they then put through this sort of homogenization machine that nobody can talk about because it's not okay to say that Ryan Coogler is actually potentially wasting some of his career by making, you know, Black Panther movies instead of telling original stories, but I digress. So you have this enormous homogenization machine that has tremendous power to affect the market. And, you know, the Matt Zoller Seitz piece that you were talking about Disney taking the 20th Century Fox library, which it purchased as part of a merger, and locking it up, it's locking it up to maximize its own profit, right? Because every screen that an archival movie is playing on is a screen that the latest Marvel or Star Wars or Pixar movie is not playing on. And it's true that a lot of cinema is accessible to people in a way that it has not been in the past and at prices that it has not been in the past. But I think that state of affairs is entirely unsustainable. And one thing that we may see happen is Disney outcompete a bunch of these other services. I mean, they're doing their best to make Disney Plus, its new streaming service, sort of absolutely mandatory to watch. They've said recently that the new Marvel movies will be incomprehensible if you haven't watched the shows that are on that network. And so,
and as we all know, cinema means having to watch a bunch of TV before you go to the movie theater.
Yes.
That's what real cinema is.
Ideally on your iPad while on a commute.
On your phone held in portrait mode.
And so it's entirely, I mean, maybe this state of affairs will last. I don't think it will, because streaming is, theoretically, we were going to have this miraculous future where everyone cut the cord and 1,000 flowers bloomed at like $3 or $4 a month, and we're all going to get exactly the content we wanted all the time.
It was going to be cheap. It was going to be almost free.
And that is absolutely not the case anymore.
Nonsense.
I mean, most Americans don't go to a lot of movies in part because they're expensive. But if you are in a position where, as a household, you're being asked to pay the equivalent of like 2 trips to the movies to get all of the stuff that you want on streaming every month, that is not going to be sustainable, and it's not necessarily going to lead to more people going to more movies. So I think it is entirely possible from a business perspective that we are heading for a future where Disney eats up the marketplace. We see a big collapse in a lot of these streaming services, and the available world of film contracts a lot, or at least gets all gobbled up by Disney, which then has no incentive to send you to any products that are not its own. I mean, we are in this sort of fake, artificial moment that I do not think can possibly last. And the presence of companies like Disney, which have been allowed to grow as large as they have, I think will probably have something to do with its end.
Peter, I want to take issue with your quasi-defense of sameness and bare bones competence in order
it's
to
more
get
than
people
bare bones.
To get people to the
theater.
It's theaters.
More than bare bones competence.
It's
Marvel movies in particular are really exquisitely well crafted.
They're okay. They're not doing anything interesting. They're
I mean, their second unit directors
right,
and their
exactly.
action sequences have gotten much less interesting over time.
There's no visual distinctive thing that makes Marvel movies be like, oh, okay, that's...
But that's why
like,
I say they're well-crafted.
They're
competent. Extremely stylish.
They're competent.
But they're exceptionally well-crafted. And think about this sort of average $90 million blockbuster of the 1990s. Lots of them actually were just kind of junky. They weren't well made at all. And you can think of the Tomb Raiders, that sort of class of movie.
Yeah, just because
that was
Marvel,
made 15
just
or
because
20
Marvel
years ago,
has
what
managed
figured out
to,
how to do is make a $150 million movie that is always pretty
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah. Just because Marvel has managed to make a same competence sort of thing does not mean it's something to be celebrated. And my issue with this is that you do train the audiences to expect and only really appreciate a certain thing. It's a bit like taking a toddler and feeding a toddler nothing but macaroni and cheese. If you feed a toddler nothing but macaroni and cheese, the toddler will be fed. The toddler will be fed, but it will grow up only wanting mac and cheese until somebody comes along and says, no, you actually have to eat, like, you know, French fries. Just eat some French fries. They're not good for you either, but, like, you know, eat those. That'll be fine. Or some, you know, apples or whatever. Like, the point is, it's this, and this isn't a eat your vegetables argument. I'm not saying everybody has to sit down and watch Silence. All right? Silence is a movie about Portuguese priests being tortured by Japanese Shintoists in the 14th century or whatever, right?
Right.
It's like, I'm not saying every movie has to be that. I'm not saying everybody has to appreciate that. But I do think that when you train the audience to only go to the movies for certain things, that is all you're going to get. And that is all we're getting right now, really. I mean, that is largely in movie theaters for large stretches of the year, except for the, like, very brief kind of Thanksgiving to New Year's Day window. That's it. That's it at the movies.
So I think that's accurate to the extent that you view cinema exclusively as something that is projected in a large multiplex, that is a large corporate-owned multiplex, because if you go to, say, the Landmark Eastery, right, one of the smaller chains that specializes.
But these are the people who are getting shut out by Disney when they're locking the vault on the 21st Century Fox stuff.
Right?
I mean,
It's nice that The Irishman exists. It's nice that Netflix made it. I do not believe for a minute that Netflix has a sustainable business model that will allow it to keep producing movies movies like The Irishman in perpetuity.
It's also that they made Roma, which I think is one of the best movies of this decade, not just of the year that it came out in. It's nice that they're making movies with Steven Soderbergh. They're doing all of this stuff, and that stuff is getting made. I don't believe it will last. There's not a sustainable business model.
And I don't believe that Disney, of all of these companies, once it has murdered every other entertainment venue, will make anything interesting at all.
So I completely agree that Disney has no incentive to make anything interesting. And I have a piece coming out in a forthcoming issue of Reason Magazine. It's a great publication. You should subscribe to it. In which I say that among the top contender for a collapse of the big streaming services is actually the original major entrant, Netflix.
Sure.
So I completely agree that this is not sustainable. However, Netflix isn't the only alternative. And you see there's just a bunch of other startups in addition to the HBO Max and Hulu, which is also sort of Disney owned but doing a different thing. You have Quibi or whatever the heck that is.
Hold on, let me
just talk you through this here. If you end up in a position where Disney is the only sort of major producer, the only game in town, that creates an opportunity for small studios to make other things. That creates, there will be market demand for something that isn't Disney, as we currently see, as films like Dragged Across Concrete demonstrate. There is a way that you can make other types of movies, and someone's going to find that. The thing that I would point to, actually, even more than Dragged Across Concrete, is Blumhouse. And what Blumhouse has done is figure out how to compete, making small-budget adult films that are actually quite interesting.
Cheapo horror movies. That's been a staple of the garbage industry for the last 50 years.
Right, but what they did was they figured... So if your argument is Disney's the only thing and they're squelching everything else out, Blumhouse proves that's not true, that it doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, Blumhouse is making really interesting, really smart movies in some cases. I think some of their movies are merely just fine, kind of like we need to make some money horror. But they're making Us. They are making Get Out. Even the new Halloween film has sort of weird kind of feminist subtext, like actually does a better job of going back to the original John Carpenter movie. And my point is, If you want to say that this moment isn't sustainable, I completely agree with you. But we don't reach a kind of end of movie history in which Disney is the only company making movies and there's no opportunity for anyone else to do anything.
Making movies is so much cheaper now than it was 20 years ago. How vertically and horizontally integrated does Disney have to be before you break it up? Is there ever a moment where you get to and you, Peter Suderman, are like, all right, we got to pull an AT&T here and split it up into baby Disneys?
As soon as they are a public service operated and owned by the government and financed by tax dollars, I will be against them.
I mean, it's lovely of you to champion Blumhouse, etc., but we seem to be in a political environment where whatever Elizabeth Warren says, there is no appetite for, you know, any investigation of monopoly whatsoever.
Good. And
fair enough. Guys, here's the question. Here's the question. Is breaking up Disney a controversy or a non-troversy? The idea of breaking Disney up, should that be controversial or non-troversial?
Non-troversial.
It shouldn't even be an idea, and Martin Scorsese, even in his piece, is like, I'm not calling for the government to get involved in this.
Well, that's what he has to say, because he's still under the thumb of Bob Iger.
Martin Scorsese is a great filmmaker who makes great movies that you can watch and that do get funded even when they're not obviously commercial. That's because we live in a good world in which the market has provided us with a lot of really interesting options and also some Disney movies.
This is all going to end with Bob Iger heeding Oprah's call to run for president and like personally brainwashing you. This is how this ends.
Okay.
I just love big corporations, guys, and I'm not kidding.
I know you do. I know you do. That's fine. You're a globalist. We can all live with that. Up next in theaters this week, Dr. Sleep, Mike Flanagan's sequel to both Stanley Kubrick's The Shining and Stephen King's The Shining. I want to emphasize the difference between the two, because Flanagan is making, he's making a sequel to a movie that is based on a book that is the sequel to a book that is very different from the movie that Dr. Sleep is following. Did you guys follow that? Have I gotten that right?
It's not just that it's different. It's that
the author of the books hated the first adaptation and wrote the sequel in part to kind of move the cultural imagination and conception of that story away from the movie version.
Even though the movie version is now sort of recognized as a masterpiece.
Yes. Ewan McGregor plays a grown-up Danny Torrance who has succumbed to alcoholism just like his father Jack. He needs booze to dull his psychic powers, but he needs his psychic powers to help stop a band of traveling vampires, the True Knot, led by the delightfully saucy Rebecca Ferguson. The first 2 hours of Dr. Sleep I found to be pretty effective as just a straight-up horror film. Pretty creepy, and the last 30 minutes or so, which takes place in a return to the Overlook Hotel, was an unmitigated disaster for reasons I'll get into shortly. But first, we should note for our listeners that our friend Alyssa had to bail on this movie mid-viewing. What happened, Alyssa?
So, as you guys know, I don't like horror very much as a genre. I will stretch for it occasionally, but it is not a genre that I enjoy. And I have a particularly hard time with cruelty towards kids and with stabbing violence. And at the hour mark of Dr. Sleep, the True Knot, led by Rose the Hat, abduct and
stab to death.
Stab to death, a little leaguer. And this was
played
not
by Jacob Tremblay from Room and Predator and a bunch of other things. Good boys.
And I had, you know, I had gone into this movie talking to you guys about the fact that I might not make it all the way through. And started to realize that there was a good chance that I was going to bail fairly early in the movie in a scene where Danny goes on an alcoholic bender, wakes up in bed with a woman who seems kind of like she's overdosed. She's like passed out in a pool of vomit, figures out that her toddler is in the apartment, sticks the kid on the bed with a bag of Cheetos and his like naked, passed out, overdosed mother, and leaves. And
It's hard. It's hard for you.
It's
hard.
Not stuff that works for me.
I read in actually some reviews that the mother is dead.
There's
not clear. It wasn't clear to me when I was watching we were supposed to take that.
There is a shot later in the film with two corpses, a woman and a child, and I think that's supposed to be them. So the idea that is that the woman died and then the child also possibly died. It's hard to tell if that's an actual vision or if it's a nightmare or whatever. But yes, I understand.
I'm a big proponent of trying to work stuff through and trying to work past your biases and phobias and everything else. And I do that with you guys. I watched The Shining for this podcast and I actually ended up loving it. But I also think I just want to mount a brief defense of bailing, because while I think that sometimes exposing yourself to difficult things that you don't have a lot of personal contact with can be a way of building empathy, but I'm also the mom to an 18-month-old. I don't actually need to watch kids suffering on screen to have a sense of what that's like in real life. Sure. I know that people can be cruel. I know that kids in pain are, you know, trigger a unique sense of helplessness in adults. I didn't need to watch it to know that. And maybe we'll try again the next time Jordan Peele makes something. But for now, I've
did you were you able to get through Us? Did you watch Us?
I did not watch Us.
Yeah.
That,
I feel like you might have trouble with that one, too. More stabbing violence.
Yeah.
Children in peril, stabbing violence.
Yeah. Those.
So
are
I don't know. I don't know if you'll be able to get through that one either. All right. Alyssa. All right, we're going to – should I mute you? Should I just hit the mute button?
I muted myself.
I won't do that. Peter, what were your thoughts? You were cooler than I was on the first 2 hours of this film.
Yeah, I didn't love it even at the beginning. I think it's really sort of – it's not exactly an awful film, but it's just terribly it's really misconceived. And it is this super awkward hybrid of Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick – that then gets cut, like the mortar the bitters where they try and join the cocktail ingredients here, ends up being Mike Flanaganism of all things. And so, the connections to Kubrick and to King are obvious. And you talked about the ways in which he sort of borrows from the movie as well as from the books. And it's a little bit, it's just an awkward fit. But then what does he do at the end? Is they go back, and there's spoilers here, obviously.
Spoilers.
You guys know this, but there's spoilers. They go back to the Overlook, and the Overlook becomes the vehicle by which the Ewan McGregor character intends to destroy Rose the Hat. And it becomes the story about family fragility and therapy culture and haunted real estate, which is exactly the story that Mike Flanagan told in his Netflix adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House. And I thought that one actually worked much better, even though it was much longer, because it actually had room to breathe, and it allowed him to explore these kind of little familial moments about sort of broken people and broken homes, and then sort of, you know, with the metaphor of relating them to literal real estate, to haunted houses, right?
So
he basically just sort of repeats himself in the space of that last 35 minutes, using a whole bunch of imagery and ideas from Stanley Kubrick that I don't think really belong there.
Sure. So let me just kind of emphasize that point by noting that I think that the first 2 hours of the film works in part as a repudiation of Stanley Kubrick's conception of The Shining, which, again, I love, I think is great. But I also understand why Stephen King didn't like it, that it's a movie about a guy who's crazy the whole time and gets crazier as he goes, whereas the book is more about a guy who was struggling to overcome his demons and kind of does at the end. I'll get to this in a second. But what one thing that Flanagan does very well in Dr. Sleep is emphasizing the importance of community for healing and for bringing people together. So in the first hour or so of the film, Ewan McGregor is trying to get over his alcoholism. He joins AA. He finds new community with this group, this town in New Hampshire that he's kind of run off to. He is able to get his life back together because he finds people to be with.
And to be of service, too.
And to be of service, too. Right.
He starts working as an orderly in this.
And he's able to use his psychic powers to help the dying people in this hospice off to the next world.
There's a real kind of thematic contrast that's both very Flanaganian and very King-esque, in that the bad guys are energy vampires who they're extremely selfish. And that's
but they also have right, their own
they feed
community.
On
but they also but what's interesting though
they feed
though, is,
on pain and their thing is my life is more important than yours.
Sure.
And that's true evil in Stephen King's moral universe.
Yes, agreed. But also, it's interesting that, again, they have their own little community. Like, they have they decide who they want to let into it and who they want to excise from it. And they are very, they in their own weird and creepy way, they are very much a little family that comes together to do their evil. Here's why the last half hour of the movie is such a disaster. If you've read the books, have you read the books?
I've not read Dr. Sleep.
I've read both of the books, and both Shining and Dr. Sleep. And the thing about Dr. Sleep, the movie, is that it takes the end of The Shining, it takes the end of Stephen King's book, The Shining, and grafts it onto the end of Dr. Sleep, the book. So what you end up having happen is in the book, in The Shining, the book, Jack Torrance has a redemptive moment. He overcomes the demons of the Overlook, which have taken him and like possessed him, essentially. And you have the exact same moment that you have at the end of Dr. Sleep, where the little girl Abra, who is helping Danny defeat Rose the Hat, says, "You're just a mask. You're just a mask. My friend Danny is still here. You know, he's better than you, and he's going to blow you up with the boilers." That literally is exactly what happens at the end of The Shining, the book. So what Flanagan has done is he has tried to pay homage to Stephen King by taking the end of the book that he really liked and that was ignored in the adaptation that everyone knows is like the only thing anyone knows of The Shining, and tried to put it at the end of his new movie as, I think, a tribute to Stephen King, to say, like, look, I'm doing this for you. It's all for you, Stephen. It's all for you. And the problem with this is that it totally subverts the message of the movie. It turns Danny into a victim that he cannot overcome his demons. He cannot overcome the things he is trying to escape. And he dies in the Overlook. The Overlook wins. Now, there's this whole little coda at the end about, like, we go on forever. You know, I'm not trapped in the... But no, the Overlook gets him, and it kills him. And it is a total... It's not even a misreading of the source material. It's just a rejection of it. It is as much a rejection of the source material as Stanley Kubrick's The Shining was, I think. Now, I supposedly Stephen King read this and he signed off on it, you know, but he says that about all of these movies that are coming out, because I'm sure he gets, you know, points If I'm sure he's got box office points somewhere in the thing.
This but is like, the third Stephen King adaptation this year, I recall correctly.
Yes, that sounds right. But I'm actually flabbergasted that nobody like saw what was happening. Was like, this is a terrible idea. You can't do this. You can't do this. This is bad. This is as bad as what Stanley Kubrick did. If you are not a fan of what Stanley Kubrick did in The Shining, I am.
Well, I also just think that
end of rant.
There's an incredibly odd stiltedness to the recreation scenes that take place in the Overlook, in which they are kind of replicating first Shelley Duvall's character and performance, yes. and then eventually
all of
Jack
the minor
Nichols,
characters,
Jack Nicholson well, and
Jack
Skatman
Nicholson,
Crothers.
but also all of like the minor ghosts yeah. from the hotel. I said this I think to Alyssa the next night. Because we saw another movie the next night, but it is very much like an So, did you guys saw Ready Player One?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's this great scene in Ready Player One where they essentially do a live walkthrough of The Shining, and they go to the Overlook
in this video game that everyone essentially lives in all the time.
And the in the movie, the Shining turns into this like roller coaster ride of a horror movie, which is very much not what it is in the original. It's like more staid and more composed. But this is like big monster swinging axes everywhere, and it's an ironic comment on the need. I think, or at least I think it is. I think it's an ironic comment on the need to kind of gamify everything to make to add excitement where it doesn't need to exist, bastardize great art in the service of entertainment,
and not just to do that, but people's desire to sort of insert themselves into these stories rather than surrendering to them.
But this is like an unironic
version of that.
It is an effort solely. To mine nostalgia and to say, remember that thing you liked? We got that. You remember that ghost with the split open head? He's like, quite a party. We got that guy. We got Jack Torrance over here. Yeah. He's playing the bartender this time.
Even the climactic fight on the stairs is set up to replicate and sort of reference that sequence between Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson in the original Shining, in which she's swinging the bat at him. And it's just like, why is this here? It's because, well, Stanley Kubrick did it. That's why.
It's a thing.
And
you've
seen. Now we're going to have our psychic battle kind of centered around this same part of the hotel as well, just because that's what Stanley Kubrick did. This sequence made me pine for CG recreations of actors. And it made me think, you know what? They might have been stilted and a little bit weird, but they would have been better than these sort of like human simulacra here that just don't seem to have any life, that don't seem to have any character to them. And so, you know, like this is yet another place where big corporations and technology good.
Oh, come on,
and could have
You wanted to Marvelize this too?
Could have made for a better movie if we just had de-aged Jack Nicholson.
I'm really excited to see you defend the performance of a hologram James Dean.
Yes,
which we are getting.
We'll get there eventually.
If and when that movie comes out,
I will develop
an opinion about it.
Peter, would you say Dr. Sleep is a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
Thumbs down.
I also give it a thumbs down. Alyssa, I'm going to assume you give it a thumbs down. If you would have stayed through the whole thing, you would have given it a thumbs down.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, not so much.
And finally, we turn to assigned viewing. Up this week is James Mangold's Walk the Line. Alyssa, why are we watching a Johnny Cash biopic this week?
Because James Mangold has coming out next week, Ford versus Ferrari, the story of how Ford decided to take on the Italian car maker at the 24-hour race at Le Mans in France. And we thought it would be interesting to look back on yet another historical story that Mangold has told, theoretically sort of about creativity and obsession. And so in Walk the Line, Joaquin Phoenix plays a young Johnny Cash during the 13 years of his courtship of June Carter, who's played by Reese Witherspoon. She won an Academy Award. She's very good. It's a different movie than Ford versus Ferrari in certain ways, in part because, well, it kind of weaves in stories of artistic creation, including the writing of Walk the Line, Ring of Fire, and the recording of Cash's incredibly important album at Folsom Prison. Those stories are sort of subordinated to the story of Cash's just long-term attempt to get June Carter to marry him. Mm-hmm. And
to get his daddy to love him.
Well, yes. That doesn't work out so well. Spoiler. But it's an interesting movie to watch because they're both, as we'll discuss next week, both movies are sort of about obsession. even if it's directed in slightly different ways. But it's watching the two of them sort of back to back, it was very interesting to me to see how much Mangold is just interested in his actors' faces, right? He's just very interested in watching people work. And so, you know, Phoenix and Witherspoon in this movie, a lot of it is just like their faces in the frame reacting to things. And it's incredibly engaging. Like, I wouldn't say I thought of Mangold before this week as like a real actor's director, but I kind of think he is.
Well, I mean, I you see that even in his Wolverine films. And yeah. So he made Logan and The Wolverine. And they're movies about, like, in some sense, about Hugh Jackman's face and about how interesting it is to look at.
Yep.
And Hugh Jackman has a really interesting face to look at, and especially in Logan, where Mangold really got let loose and got to kind of make the movie, I think, that he really wanted to make. What you see is that it is a performance-driven movie about a taciturn kind of middle-aged guy having like a crisis of identity, and that's the kind of movie that he has been making for decades. He made Copland. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's actually this great Sylvester Stallone movie about a cop who is the sheriff or like the chief of police or something in a town in, I believe it's New Jersey. That is where all the New York cops live. And of course, then there's a bunch of corruption and there's all of these sort of complications. And he's always been kind of interested in men growing old and trying to figure themselves out. And that's a lot of what Walk the Line is about. That's certainly a lot of what Logan is about. We'll talk more about Ford v. Ferrari next week. But the other thing that I learned that I did not know when I was looking up his filmography is that he wrote the 1988 Disney animated film Oliver and Company. He is a co-writer. He's actually credited co-writer on Oliver
and
Company.
The Disney Plus title.
Yeah, Disney gave him his first chance. Oh, and God. We would not have Walk the Line, Ford v. Ferrari, and probably the best, one of the best and most sort of auteurish superhero movies of the last decade without Disney signing him on in his early 20s and saying, here's a directing and writing deal. Mm-hmm. Go write an animated movie about dogs and cats reenacting Oliver Twist.
Thank God for capitalism. Here's my main thought on watching Walk the Line was I actually had not seen it. I had not seen it before a couple days ago. And I was watching it, and all I could think was, wow, this Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, really nailed it. Really, it is a pitch perfect parody. I could not take the movie seriously because I'd seen the parody before I'd seen the real thing. This is not a comment on James Mangold, who is obviously a talented filmmaker. There were lots of great individual shots where it was just like he's clearly a craftsman. He understands how the camera works. The performances were all very good. Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic, and we should mention that Joaquin Phoenix has now been nominated for, I think, 3 Oscars, and I think is arguably the front runner for the Joker, the $1 billion almost grossing Joker, and should have a decent chance at a trophy here. But he's very, very good in this movie, sort of musical biopics, it's totally thankless. It's like how close can you get to the original? He's really quite wonderful in it. That said, again, just structurally and like thematically and beat for beat, it is exactly like the parody. And I have trouble taking it seriously. Has that ever happened to you guys before where you watch something after seeing something that has made fun of it and you just like can't? You just can't even.
I'm sure it has. I can't think of it. I actually think that in part because people know June Carter less well, which is sort of a problem for music history, Witherspoon's probably better in the movie than
she's
he is.
She's so good.
She dominates every scene she's in.
It's insane. Yeah. And part of what's really, I mean, I think part of the reason that's true is because Cash presents as this sort of naif in a certain way, right? Like there's this scene where June Carter's talking to him about how he just never takes either sort of credit or responsibility for anything he does. He just sort of presents himself as someone to whom things happen. But she is someone who is navigating a lot of really difficult stuff in a very conscious way. She grew up as this sort of Christian family singer. She has these 2 marriages that fail, so she's trying to manage her reputation while she is falling in love with this person who is difficult, who is sort of, you know, encouraging her to cheat on her husband, who is, you know, clearly a genius, but also a complete mess. And so just seeing her in scene from scene, like, there are a number of scenes in the movie where you see her go from off stage to on stage. And that transformation is always incredible, because it's not that she is, like, I mean, she's completely compelling and interesting and charming off stage, but you actually, instead of seeing her get bigger the way performers often do, you see her sort of lock herself into this formula in a way that is really sort of tight and controlled. And the movie doesn't do a great job of sort of developing this artistically, unfortunately, because, I mean, the story of how Ring of Fire was written is kind of contested, both by, you know, she's told her version, Cash told his version. Cash's ex-wife, who's played by Jennifer Goodwin, also quite well in this movie, has sort of a third version. But it would have been very interesting to see her evolution as an artist in relation, you know, in as part of this relationship, which became incredibly sort of creatively fruitful for both of them. But yeah, I mean, her story is almost more interesting because she's making conscious choices at every step in the way, where Cash is just sort of floating along partially on this, you know, long suppressed tidal wave of grief about the death of his brother, which is, again, very well done. But I wonder, I mean, there's a different version of it that's either more about their creative partnership or specifically about the fight to get at Folsom Prison made, which is sort of the last act of the movie.
It's like, it's not even really an act. It's just like two scenes. Are like,
it's dramatized in one or two scenes.
Yeah. They're like, we don't want you to do this. We want to do it.
We're going to do
then,
it.
And then
here's
they do
the
it.
Con- yeah, yeah, like, here's like the concert and it goes well.
I don't, there's an extended version of this movie, but I was like, I can do it. I can do the 135 minute version. I don't need the 150 minute version.
Yeah. I mean, I think Ford versus Ferrari, which we'll talk about next week, is a better movie in part because it has a much sort of tighter narrative structure. And I mean, it just, it, the theme is played out by the plot in a way that is not really true in Walk the Line, but it's fun to watch Walk the Line just to see, again, that kind of attention that Mangold plays to his actors' faces. And honestly, a lot of what is fun about Ford versus Ferrari is just watching James Mangold watch Christian Bale and Matt Damon. There's literally a scene where Damon monologues and chews gum. It's almost sort of a joke, but it's a delight to watch him watch other people.
Yeah, we'll get to that next week. But yeah, I Walk the Line. It's not as funny as Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story.
It's not as good as its two central performances.
Yeah.
I think I mean, it has the trouble that a lot of biopics have, which is that there's really a convention, a formula for how these stories have to be told. And Mangold makes the case in a lot of ways for the convention.
Yeah.
Like, he shows you why it's there and why it works. At the same time, he just can't escape it. And it's hard to think of a movie, especially in the musical biopic space, that escapes that formula and convention in a way that works.
Yeah.
Love and Mercy. Have you guys seen Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson biopic?
Paul Dano plays him
sort of during the period when he's making Pet Sounds and falling apart. It's really good in part because it's really relentlessly sad. Like, it doesn't necessarily have sort of an upbeat coda. It's just, I mean, it's a very sort of intimate portrait of someone in tragedy, and the fact that he is going through all of this is almost more important than the music he's creating. It's a strong exception to the genre, but it's rare.
I do think that it tells you something about Mangold, who co-wrote the screenplay for Walk the Line, that he chose to make the story, the essential story, not about musical success, but about love, about marriage, right? And so it's like the climactic moment is not actually beating the suits and getting the record made at Folsom Prison. The climactic moment is when the Reese Witherspoon character says, "Yes, I'll marry you."
Yes.
And it's a movie about men and women more than it is a movie about music, I think. And that's kind of interesting, is that he just wants to focus on these sort of fundamental human relationships. And you can imagine a Johnny Cash movie that is really about the struggles he had with drugs and with record studios, in which in which his, you know, the women in his life were not secondary players, but something much less. Mm. And you can even imagine something like that from somebody like Mangold, who's really interested in male struggle. And I think it's a better movie for the fact that it brings the Reese Witherspoon character in and makes her so central and gives her actually, I mean, humanizes her in a way that, didn't have to.
I would say with Johnny Cash, I actually think it's hard to make that movie that you're talking about without having June be a huge part of it. Because, I mean, that marriage was so legendary and foundational. That courtship was so important. But part of what's interesting about Walk the Line is that it doesn't end on this note of unalloyed triumph, right? I mean, he's gotten her to say yes, but you've seen over the past 2 hours and 20 minutes all of the reasons that she would say no. And so it's triumphal. It's beautiful. They're on stage in London. He kind of does this public proposal, which, you know, maybe problematic by today's standards. And she kind of gives in. I mean, he's proposed to her like 40 times. She keeps saying no. And he keeps proposing to her in ways that are like kind of pushy and weird. But you have the sense that she's agreed to marry him knowing fully what she's getting into. And it might not be so great all of the time. Like, he's a really serious drug addict. He's depressive. He's irresponsible. He's also incredibly charming and talented. And she loves him. And he is sort of a champion of her voice and her artistry in a way that no one else in her life is. But you're seeing the full compromise. And that does make it a very interesting movie and a very interesting ending.
It should be noted that the formulaic and plain and one could say Disney-fied Walk the Line grossed 10 times what Love and Mercy grossed.
Oh,
there's a reason. There's a reason they stick to that formula. It's because people love their macaroni and cheese, because that's all they've been fed. And that's all they want. I mean, that's all the time we have for this week.
We saw the same thing with Bohemian Rhapsody,
all the time,
right?
We have for this week. Assigned viewing for next week is Casino, in preparation for Martin Scorsese's new MCU movie, The Irishman. That's it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple and elsewhere. We need those reviews, people. If you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter, at Sonny Bunch. I love hearing from random people who hate the things I do. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show on your podcast feed. See you next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonnier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.